Welcome to the Health, Wealth, and Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Hagen, a nutrition coach, entrepreneur, food freedom expert, and forever a recovering disordered eater. I am here to help you own your enoughness, find your very own food freedom, and achieve your health and wellness goals in a way that gives more than it takes. Each week, I will provide you with insight and inspiration surrounding no-nonsense nutrition, mindset, motivation, body image, confidence, and other wellness wisdom. Oh my gosh, friend, I just hopped off an amazing interview with Karin Nordine. I have been following Karin for years on social media and have been a huge fan of hers for a long, long time. When I recently saw that Karin was opening up her schedule to be a guest expert on podcasts, I jumped at one of those openings because I knew that the value she would provide to us on the podcast would be invaluable. So I'm going to share a conversation with you. But before I do, I want to introduce you to Karin. Karin is a loving dog mom, Funfetti flavor super fan, and self-help book encyclopedia. And by the way, she also happens to be a PhD expert in health behavior change and published mindset theory researcher. After graduating with her doctorate, Karin had a striking realization. The typical self-help and productivity approaches of the personal development industry were shockingly inconsistent with the actual research on change. That inconsistency became the fuel for her business, Body Brain Alliance, where she's on a mission to teach compassion-first change techniques and help dedicated self-improvers become their 2.0 selves. Karin and I have an amazing conversation together where I ask her about the stages of change, what is required to successfully change health behaviors, and the timeline that we can expect to navigate replacing a behavior that's not serving us anymore with one that does. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Karin Nordine. Hooray! Okay, let's dive right in. I would first and foremost, Karin, love for you to tell us about yourself. So I always have a fun little icebreaker question that I ask podcast guests, and that is, regardless of your relationship status, what would your dating profile say? Give us the juicy details.
What would my dating profile say? Hi, I'm Karin. I'm a PhD level expert in behavior change. If I was dating and my dating profile, I usually put something in it about how I'm like a super fan of like Funfetti flavored things. I include something like that. When I was dating and I was on Tinder or Hinge or whatever it was, my bio said two truths and a lie. And I can't remember. I think one of my truths was that I was born in Sweden, which was the lie, actually, because I was not born in Sweden, but I do speak Swedish. My family lives over there. I'm Swedish. So that was the lie. And then the two truths were, number one, I absorbed my twin in the womb, which is just kind of like a random fun fact about me. It happens a lot, but they just happen to know for sure that I did. And then what was my other one? Oh, I think I used to say at that time that I had never gotten my nails done, which was true at that time, but then I started getting it done. So it's not the case anymore.
I can see how that would be a little bit of a trick question, though, if you speak Swedish and you have family in Sweden.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I am also a big fan of Funfetti, and I do not speak any other languages. So your dating profile is much more fun than mine. Not that I ever had one. I met my husband before I had to introduce myself to the world of online dating. But tell us more about you being a PhD in behavior change, because that is so fascinating and so inspirational. How did that happen? Like, did you always know you wanted to do this work? What's the story there?
No. So I'll give you like my little backstory. I always say that it started with like, I have this vivid memory of third grade, and I'm sitting near this girl named Valerie Carlson in my class. And someday Valerie is going to like hear these interviews and be like, this girl will not stop talking about me. But I'm sitting near Valerie Carlson, And the teacher's like, okay, grab your stuff. We're going to like do an activity. And so she takes like this purple folder that's like crisp and clean. And she takes out this pencil case and she like neatly pulls out a pencil and everything's like put away. And I look at my backpack and my backpack is like disaster zone. My backpack is like crumpled pieces of paper and like pencil shavings. And I have no idea where my like pencils are that I'm looking for. And in that moment, as early as like third grade, I remember thinking like, I have to fix this. Like, I have to fix myself. I have to be better. I have to be more organized. And so I kind of had this like insatiable desire to improve myself that originally came from a really toxic place. I got my bachelor's degree in psychology because of that. I was pretty lost. And so I was like, well, I'm interested in people and how they think and this like self-help stuff. So I'll get a degree in psychology. And then I actually ended up getting a master's degree in communication purely because I competed on a speech and debate team. And I got offered a job that would come with a free master's degree where I would coach the speech and debate team at that school. So I was like, okay, we'll do this. So I get a master's degree. I actually start studying domestic violence and domestic violence prevention. And that's what I originally was going to do in my PhD. I was going to take a health behavior approach to studying domestic violence. What I really wanted to figure out is how do we change people's bystander behavior? How do we make people better bystanders so they like intervene? But I got to my PhD and my advisor was studying growth mindset. And I immediately, like first month of my PhD, was very intrigued because I had read about growth mindset. I had like read Dweck's book. And so I started going through this whole degree that was really about health psychology and behavior change. And I was like, wait, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is not the same stuff that I've been reading in self-help books. In fact, this stuff is like different. This stuff contradicts the like typical advice that's coming from these gurus who have lots of life experience, but no connection to the actual science. And so in my PhD, I really leaned into behavior change and started applying to my own life, the things I was learning. And that's when I actually started to see my behavior change. I started to work out consistently. I started to eat healthier. I had a morning routine for the first time in my life. Like all of these things I had been struggling with for literal decades, I finally had this scientific knowledge on how to actually change those things in a way that was compassionate and a way that was centered in self-love instead of self-hate. And so I absolutely fell in love. And originally I was going to go teach at the university level, and then there was a pandemic and I didn't want to be at a tiny school in the middle of nowhere completely alone. And so I pivoted and I signed up to, I looked into being a nutrition coach, and that's how things kind of grew from there.
Wow. Okay. So there were a lot of pivots in your story, which I can understand. So I have a bachelor's in psychology as well before pivoting to nutrition science and public health, but I didn't know about the domestic violence interest in your past. So that's fascinating to me. Karin, I want to ask you this because I think those who are listening who have heard the term behavior change may know about the stages of change that are often like promoted or talked about when we're talking about behavior change. Tell us more about those. Is there validity to the stages of change? What are they, if there is validity to them? And kind of a sub point to that, how important is readiness when it comes to behavior change?
Yes. Okay. So the stages of change, very briefly, is a model of how the change process works. And a lot of the original research on the stages of change actually dealt with like smoking cessation. If you look at the original research on health behavior change in public health, a lot of it came from that. And so that's why in the stages of change, you see it's pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, maintenance. But there's this idea that you can, and they use the word, quote, relapse at any point, and you can go back to any of those stages. So it's a very helpful visual model. Now, what people will tell you, what researchers will tell you about the stages of change is that it's a really helpful way of thinking about things. Sometimes it's not as clear cut. And we don't, a lot of people think you sort of like move in a linear fashion from stage to stage to stage. And that's actually, that's not necessarily true. You can kind of hop all over the place. My favorite thing I think that's useful about the stages of change is not actually the model itself, but the fact that there's a ton of research on how we specifically move from one phase to another. And those moves are different. So for example, if you're in the pre-contemplation phase of, say, starting a gym habit, that means you're not really thinking about it. You're not really, it's not on your mind. You've maybe thought about it like once or twice, but you're not considering like, oh, maybe I want to start going to the gym. Like you're not at that place yet, right? And what we know in that original phase is that something called awareness raising is really helpful. So that is where it's helpful to think about the benefits of working out. It's helpful to get educated on what that's going to do for you long term, all of that kind of stuff. So then you start to think, oh, maybe working out would be good for me. Maybe I should work out. And that puts you in the contemplation phase. What I think is really interesting, what I think people need to learn from the stage of change is that once you get to the contemplation stage, more emphasis on the sort of broad benefits of a health behavior is not really helpful to you. So this is why people will say, like, I know how good it is for me to do this, but I just don't do it, right? We think that if we understand the benefits, that will automatically create a behavior, and that's not necessarily the case. Instead, what happens is that a factor called decisional balance comes in. And that's basically you weighing your personal pro-cons list. And even if exercising has a lot of pros, if you see it also having a lot of personal cons in your life, so maybe you feel like it takes time away from your kids and it's kind of nerve-wracking and you're sweaty afterwards and then you have to take an extra shower, like all of those little things matter, and that can keep you in the contemplation stage and keep you from moving to that next preparation stage where you would actually get ready to do the thing.
Is this similar to the knowing doing gap? Like more education, more knowledge is not necessarily going to cause action. Like it's not going to help me get to that stage, even though I may be in contemplation.
Yes, 100%. And that's because we know that you can know everything in the world and still struggle with something. Like I arguably am an expert in behavior change, and there are still aspects of my own behavior that I struggle with. And there are reasons that I have my own behavior change coach to help me with that as well.
So is readiness to change a behavior essentially that pro-con list, that personal pro-con list you were talking about, where if we don't see the value of the pros as outweighing the cons, then essentially we're not ready or willing, maybe is a better way to phrase that, to engage in the change?
Yes. So that's part of it. And then the other part of readiness is something called self-efficacy. So that's basically like, do I actually believe that I can succeed, that I can accomplish this task, that I can get the results I want? And that's where you have that sort of on again, off again mentality, or you have this sense of like, oh, I really want to do this, but I'm scared to start. That might be because your decisional balance is telling you, yes, this is beneficial. I do want this in my life, but your self-efficacy is saying it doesn't matter if I want it because it's impossible for me because I'm never going to get there. So we have to raise that self-efficacy in order to have true readiness and then true action.
How do we do that? Because essentially, it sounds to me like you're talking about, and you referenced this earlier on in our conversation, going from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset, which sounds like it was a huge part of your personal transformation. So I know I'm asking a ginormous question, but are there tactics we can utilize to increase self-efficacy?
Yes. So there are really two things that help with self-efficacy. Number one is giving yourself mastery experiences. So let's say that you want to go to the gym for the first time. Let's continue using that example, right? A mastery experience might be you convincing yourself to just go in, ask for a tour, and then leave. But what you've done in that moment, once you've accomplished that thing, is you've taken your big goal of going to the gym regularly, you've distilled it down to one experience that feels doable for you, and you've created this feedback loop of like, I tried it, I did it. So that is a mastery experience. It comes from actually like the world of child psychology and a lot of like youth development research, where they were looking at children who were able to successfully solve a really easy puzzle. They tend to do better at the harder puzzles versus the same kids. You put them right into the harder puzzles because they have that self-efficacy from the first experience. So that's one way. And then the number two way, which I always like to say sort of immediately boosts self-efficacy, is working alongside a coach or enrolling in some sort of program or giving yourself support and resources that are going to solve the gap of like, why can't I do this? So a lot of people are like, I don't know how, I don't have the accountability. And that's where a coach or a program or some sort of support can come in and sort of immediately boost that sense of self-efficacy.
Sure. Yeah. I love that because essentially it's helpful to have someone else believe in you before maybe you are ready to believe in you, but being surrounded by that kind of environment is hugely supportive and obviously grows our belief in ourselves. I am curious as to the biggest barriers you see when it comes to clients trying to change. Maybe we narrow it down to like health behaviors. A lot of what we talk about around here is healthy eating habits and of course, intentional movement, self-care practices. What are some of the biggest barriers that clients identify as being the reason why they struggle creating change?
Yeah. So I think probably the number one barrier I see that people struggle with when it comes to change is all or nothing thinking or perfectionism. And that can be really subtle. So the majority of people who I've seen who are experiencing perfectionism do not actually identify as perfectionists because they will tell you nothing I've ever done has been perfect. So how could I be a perfectionist? And it's the exact perfectionism that is giving them that idea. And so what happens is that maybe they've set a goal to eat healthier this week. They've set a goal to eat more vegetables this week. And on day one, they do really great. And then on day two, they don't have that serving of vegetables they promised that they've had, they would have at dinner. And so then on day three, even if they don't recognize it, often this goes completely unaddressed in their brain. But on day three, they're kind of feeling negative about day two. And they start to say to themselves, well, like, I didn't do it yesterday. Well, if I didn't do it yesterday, am I even going to keep this up? If I don't even keep this up, like, is it even worth doing right now? And so there's this sort of low grade drop in self-efficacy and this low grade increase in like, this doesn't matter, kind of that like, screw it, F it syndrome. And that's what derails people because the majority of people who are dealing with this just need to line up more days in a row and they'll start seeing the changes that they're looking for. So that would be number one. And then the second one I'll mention, I talk about this all the time, is kind of related. People get hyper fixated on the idea of consistency. So they're like, if I'm not, we have all these messages around, if you're going to do it consistently, focus on consistency. I once polled my audience and 80% of my audience said that a coach telling them to be consistent did not feel helpful for them. And I asked them why, and they were like, because I can't, like, I don't feel like I can achieve consistency. And so every time I try, it's just another slap in the face. Like, I'll never get what I want because I can't be consistent. And so what I tell clients is before you focus on doing something consistently, just focus on doing it more frequently. Don't worry about lining it up, doing everything in a row. Just back up, pull it back. Do something once, eat a vegetable once, then eat a vegetable more often. And then eventually in the future, if you really want to, you can start focus on doing things consistently.
Which is doing it more consistently, right? Like just doing it more frequently is doing it more consistently, but maybe it's how we're defining consistency that feels too big and maybe almost resorting back to that all or nothing thinking mindset.
Yes. So even if you think about it, like once a week, you could still consider that to be consistent, right? But going from 2 times per month to 3 times per month is an increase in frequency. So frequency doesn't have that tie to like timing or regularity that most people associate with consistency. And that kind of tends to dissipate some of the all or nothing thinking and has been really, really helpful for the clients that at least we're working with in our program.
That's so fascinating. So essentially it's just like putting in more reps, and it doesn't necessarily matter that you're doing it X number of times a week or consistently. As I'm going to have to be careful about how often I use the word consistency, because I feel like I talk about it a lot. This is helpful.
And it might work, you know, it might work for you. It might work for your people. And for some people, it really does resonate for sure. 100%. I just think it's very interesting that we tend to like gravitate towards that. And when we do, we undercut the benefits of doing something once. Like if you, every single time you eat a vegetable, it helps you. You don't have to eat vegetables consistently in order for the act of eating a vegetable to be beneficial. And I think when we focus more on the results you're getting from an action and not the results you're going to get in the future from stringing a bunch of actions together, that can be really helpful in like recentering people on today and now and reducing that all or nothing thinking.
Absolutely. The way I think about it, this is just coming to me listening to you, is consistency is a step down from perfectly, which as a self-identifying recovering perfectionist, that feels like less pressure. And I know, oh, I don't have to do something perfectly, even if I'm doing it consistently. But what I'm hearing you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, is frequently is even better, because it's a step down from consistency, which can sometimes feel overwhelming, even to people who may or may not be identifying perfectionists.
Absolutely. And even further down from that, when you're starting a new habit, just do it once. Like, for goodness sakes, don't tell yourself, like, let's say you're going to do a morning routine and you want to start waking up at 5 a.m. If you've never woken up at 5 a.m. before, don't focus on waking up at 5 a.m. consistently. Just do it once and see how it goes. Like, we can start with a single action. And a lot of times, especially with newer health behaviors, we're like, okay, I just need to take my vitamins consistently. Take your vitamins tomorrow. That's it. That's all you got to worry about.
Which then, reverting back to what we were talking about before, kind of builds that self-efficacy in terms of like, I did this thing once. I believe now that I could probably do it a second time.
Yes, 100%.
Okay, so let's quickly reference that all or nothing thinker that you mentioned being one of the bigger barriers to creating successful change. Is the solution there breaking down the, I want to eat more vegetables today? So the person who's maybe getting frustrated on day two because they didn't do the thing that they set out to do, and then on day three, they're like, fuck it, spiral. There's no point to doing this. What the hell? Is the goal to make it smaller and more manageable?
Not necessarily, because what we're really going for to reduce all or nothing thinking is something called cognitive flexibility. And that's, if we reduce it down to something smaller, we can still be in this perfectionist idea, which is why the concept of tiny habits, I've actually seen it backfire for clients, because they distill something down to such a tiny behavior that they should be able to do it effortlessly every day, no problem. And then they don't. And then they have this like cycle of like, I can't even do this tiny thing consistently. Like, how am I ever going to be able to change? Right. So what I prefer people do, what I typically direct people to do to adopt more cognitive flexibility is two things. I just held up a one for those of you who are listening on this podcast. Two things. Okay. Number one is, I encourage you, and this is part of the framework we teach, to associate each behavior with a value. So let's say you want to get out for more intentional movement every day. You want to go for a walk. Maybe that walk embodies your value of being active. And one day it's storming outside. While that would normally derail a perfectionist thinker who's like, well, I can't go outside. It's dangerous to be out there. There's lightning. I can't go for my walk today. And then tomorrow that perfectionist thinker is going to be like, oh, I didn't go yesterday. Da-da-da, ruined my streak, blah, blah, blah. What we can do instead is say, okay, if the habit of walking is tied to a value, how can I still embody that value in a different way? So maybe that looks like I'm going to do a 20-minute workout that I found on YouTube in order to still be active, even though my exact habit cannot occur under the circumstances. So in our program, we have our clients pick four values and four habits, and they link them together. And so that way, every single behavior always has a value backup, which helps them be more flexible with it. And then the other thing number two, is to, when you're forming those habits, intentionally write out a spectrum of what is the sort of highest version of this behavior and what is the like absolute bare minimum of this behavior, so that you kind of plan for that and you give your brain that tool in advance.
I love that, which helps with all or nothing thinking. We do the same thing with food. Like, just because you can't have the most whole of the earth food doesn't mean that whatever you're choosing is tang, you know, like powdered orange substance that like isn't unrecognizable nutritionally, which there's nothing wrong with enjoying that either. But spectrum, what's yes. the next best thing that I can do, essentially, is the helpful reframe that you're sharing. Okay. I recently saw you post about, well, it may not be recently now, but in my brain, it feels recent, about why we should stop trying to break bad habits. And I would love for you to tell us more about that. So perhaps the person who wants to move more intentionally is currently coming home from work, crashing on the couch, scrolling while watching Netflix, you know, like the multiple screen thing that we like to do. And they are thinking, I need to break this habit. This is not working for me. Why isn't that effective? Can you tell us more?
So I want you to imagine two people and both of them are running. One of them is running away from a tiger. One of them is running towards the finish line. Think about the mood, the facial expressions, the emotion, the vibe you would get from each of those people. The person running away from a tiger is probably scared, fearful, concerned, worried. The person running towards a finish line is probably persistent, hopeful, excited. And so that is the difference between an avoidance goal of, I don't want to do this, I want to stop doing this, an approach goal, which is, I want to add this into my life, I want to encourage myself to do this, I'm moving towards something. So reason number one is that when you're moving towards something, it's a completely different emotional feel than trying to avoid something. But the second reason, and this is more like cognitive or neurological, I would say, is that if you don't give your brain something to move towards, you're just creating a gap in your life. So if you're coming home and crashing on the couch every day, that action, whether you like it or not, one of the things they say at PN, my former workplace, is that all behavior solves a problem. And so that crash on the couch is solving a problem. And if you simply just try to avoid crashing on the couch, number one, you can jump into other behaviors that are equally as unhelpful. Or number two, you're just thinking the whole time. It's like, if I tell you don't think about a white rabbit, you're going to think about a white rabbit the whole time. So instead, what we can do is we can say, what do I want to be doing? If I don't want to be crashing on the couch and scrolling on my phone, number one, when do I want to allow myself to be on the couch scrolling my phone? Because a lot of people tend to be like, oh, this really human thing that I have a desire to do, I'm never going to do it again. And that's unrealistic. So when is my phone scrolling time? And number two, if I don't want to phone scroll right that second, what am I going to do? What is going to feel restorative during that time? What is going to bring me back to a calm baseline in the same way that that scrolling activity was doing? So it really helps you find an alternate activity that you can move towards that's going to fulfill the same need. And then in that moment, you can also say, hey, brain, I know you really want to scroll right now, but tonight at 8 o'clock, we have our scrolling time. We have our cozy couch time with our partner. It's going to be amazing. We're going to do it then. But right now we need to go for a walk or do X or Y or whatever.
I'm obsessed with that. And I'm thinking, I know you have some nutrition background, so tell me what your thoughts are on this. I'm thinking that's why nutrition by addition works so much more effectively than worrying about cutting something out, eliminating a food group. Similarly to the runner analogy you gave us, it's so much more rewarding, and the psychological stance of us trying to like incorporate more of what my body needs and what's going to leave me feeling really good ends up being a much more sustainable, but also a much more feel good approach to take.
Yes, 100%. That's exactly how that works. And that also, from a nutritional standpoint, helps with kind of this like crowd out mentality. So you're in your life, you have a finite amount of time for habits. In your stomach, you have a finite amount of space at any given time, despite, you know, every one of us having a dessert compartment that expands as soon as dinner is over. But like in those moments, filling that space with more of the good stuff is going to naturally crowd out the stuff that we're ready to leave behind.
Without focusing on, oh, I can't have that, or I shouldn't be eating this. Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, Karin, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, because this, we're in Q4 of 2023, which I can't believe, but here we are. And I'm thinking that when this episode debuts, there's going to be people thinking about upcoming holidays, which is just mind-blowing. I can't believe we're there. And New Year's resolutions, maybe things that they want to recommit to, or things that they want to change, or habits that they would like to replace a bad habit with a habit that's serving them. So what are your thoughts on making resolutions or change goals? And perhaps how can we do that, depending on your thought process, most successfully?
Yes. So this is a huge question, and there are a lot of different ways that you can go about doing this. But I encourage people, especially at this time of year, to really focus on two things in Q4. Number one is to think about the person you want to be. This is what we call the future self framework. It's an evidence-based framework. And it's like, okay, if you're the 1.0 version of you, who very broadly is the 2.0 version of you? What does that person's day look like? What are that person's habits? And one thing I would caution you against is that your future self is not a magical version of you that doesn't encounter the problems that you encounter. So a lot of people are like, oh, well, my future self, she's never rushing her kids out of the door in the morning. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not realistic. That's not going to happen. Instead, you want to ask yourself, if my future self was encountering the same exact problems that I hit this year, how is that person handling it differently? So I like to start thinking about that, because a lot of times if we go straight towards like, what goals should I set? What habits should I pick up? That kind of thing. What we end up is we end up doing a lot of shoulds. Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to eat healthy because I should. I'm going to stop scrolling because I should. I'm going to meditate or journal. Those are two big ones that I see that people are like, those are both good things. But a lot of times people choose them because they're like, oh, I should feel like I should be journaling. They have no actual intrinsic motivation. So focusing on the future you helps you actually get in touch with, who do you want to be? What are you craving? What do you want your life to look like? So that's thing number one. And then thing number two is, instead of trying to lock in your resolutions before January 1st, I encourage you to think about December as a month of experimentation. So if you want to next year, let's say one of your New Year's resolutions is to, mine this year was to eat 2,023 servings of plants throughout the year. So I have a running count. I'm on track.
Wow.
For anybody who wants to know. And so let's say that that's what you want your resolution to be. What that might look like is experimenting in December. How are the different ways that I could play around with to get more plants into my diet? What would that look like? What would that do? So viewing December as this experimentation month, number one, gets you thinking about your future self in the face of obstacles, because there are lots of holiday obstacles in December. And number two, it's more of a playful approach versus like, oh my gosh, I have to set these resolutions and they have to be perfect and they have to be SMART goals and they have to be this, that, and the other thing. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's step back. Think about who you want to be, some of the things that person might be doing, and let's play around with them for a month before we go any further.
Which essentially is preparing you to be more successful when 2024 does roll around, right? It's the difference between today me isn't going to think about that. Like, I'm going to put that off on tomorrow me versus, well, what tiny little thing can I do today to start experimenting with how I can incorporate more plants, even when I have a super busy day or I have a Christmas party later this week or whatever.
Yes. And anecdotally, what we have seen in the clients who start with us in October, November, December, is that the clients who start with us during that period of time and the habits that they start during that period of time tend to actually be more long lasting because they are created while the obstacles are happening. So it forces you to be very essentialist. It forces you to be very creative. So I personally think the holidays are like the best time of year to start experimenting with changes you want to make, habits you want to form, the person you want to be, because it is ripe with challenges. And that helps you think in really, really fun and creative ways.
That makes sense to me. As a coach, I could confidently say that I see the same thing, but I've kind of chalked it up to the fact that it's a difference in mindset and perspective of, oh, I don't have to wait for the perfect time, I'm using air quotes, to start moving towards this goal. I don't have to show up perfectly January 1st and then perfectly for 2 weeks, 2 months, whatever, till I fall off the wagon. I can start now, even if it's messy.
Yes. I always tell people the best thing that you can do for your goal during the first 2 weeks of the year is mess up. Because if you don't mess up, if you hold yourself to total perfectionism that 2 weeks, then the stakes are getting higher and higher. Versus if you mess up on the second day and then you get back on the wagon, awesome. Then you've accomplished that. You've gotten through that obstacle and you're ready to go for the rest of the year.
Karen, what can we tell ourselves? Do you have like little mantras or like a helpful little reframe when that old, like, oh, I'm such an epic failure. I can't believe that I didn't do this thing. It's only the second day. This is a small thing. Why can't I do it? Like, what can we say to kind of clap back to that all or nothing mindset that maybe has been conditioned?
One of the best ways you can start combating that little voice in your head that is going to tell you like, we should just give up. It's not going to work. This is worthless. Da 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 da. Is to actually name that voice. And what that does is it personifies, it puts you as like you versus that voice in your head. So like I call mine Karen because my name is pronounced Karen. So in my head, I'm like, okay, well, Karen thinks that it's not even worth it to go to the gym today because we didn't go yesterday. Isn't that ridiculous that Karen thinks that? So that's number one, is to name the voice. And then the other technique that I have is I actually prefer not to fight with that voice because then you get into it, right? It's like, don't engage in an argument you actually don't want to be a part of. Instead, I prefer to think of that voice as either like a parrot where it's just repeating things it's heard before. There's actually no meaning behind it. Or like a spam message. I got a message from Wells Fargo 42916 this morning that said all of my accounts were hacked and all of my money was gone. And I said, ha, and deleted the text message. So your brain is allowed to send you negativity. Your brain is allowed to send you pushback. Your brain is allowed to send you ideas that you've moved past, right? And we don't have to get mad at our brain. We don't have to be like, oh, why do I always have this resistance to the gym? Oh, why do I always like have this resistance to eating healthier? Why do I always feel this way? No, allow the feelings and thoughts to come up and be there. And instead of fighting them, just say, okay, you're allowed to be here. You're allowed to be heard. You're allowed to be on the bus, but I am the one who's driving and I don't have to listen or behave based on those thoughts.
Okay, I've never heard the parrot analogy before, but I'm kind of obsessed with it because you're not going to like get super frustrated simply because a parrot is repeating something that has been said before. That's what a parrot does, right? So it makes sense that our brain, maybe that's been a neural pathway that we participated in for years or decades, that it's going to pop up an old thought. I like to think of it like white noise, like the ads that you see on Instagram or Facebook or something. After time, you just scroll past them and you're like, okay, this is bullshit. I don't need to pay any attention to this. Yeah, that makes so much sense. Okay, last question I want to ask you. Well, I want to ask you about 17,000 more questions, but the last question I will ask you because I'm reining it in today is, can you talk to us a little bit about the timeline of lasting behavior change? I know that there's this 21 day number that's commonly touted as it takes 21 days to make a habit. Is there any validity to that? How can we maybe set ourselves up for success to anticipate how long it may take in order to change a behavior?
Yes. So let's start with talking about what a habit is. A habit is one single action that can be considered or that could become automatic. Buckling your seatbelt in the car is a habit. Going to the gym is not a habit. We talk about it as if it's a habit, but going to the gym will never be automatic. It is too many behaviors and too much complexity and too much intensity strung together. You will always have to think about it. And so part of, I think, the frustration, the cultural frustration with habits is that we're expecting things to become automatic that are actually behaviors that are complex enough that they will never be automatic. They will always require some sort of thought. Now, different pieces of that may become more automatic. And there are people out there, I'm sure, who may feel like going to the gym feels very normal for them. But I guarantee there's still some cognitive thought going into that process every single day. And so we need to normalize our expectations of what is a habit and what's not, because people are talking about it incorrectly. Number two, when we look at actual habits, something like as simple as buckling a seatbelt, there have been studies that show that habit formation ranges from anywhere from like 30 all the way to about 270 days. So it's going to take you, depending on the habit, depending on how rigid you are with it, depending on how repetitive it is, depending on a whole bunch of factors, it's going to take you anywhere from a month to a year to form a habit. And that's kind of sometimes stings for people to hear because they want to get rid of that battle in their head. They want it to feel automatic. And what I always tell people to kind of comfort them in that circumstance is, wouldn't you rather know that you can navigate that conversation every day rather than relying on something to be automatic, like immediately. We also know from research that really behavior change, in order to last, behavior change needs to be sustained for a minimum of 6 months. So when you look at our clients in our program and their success, our most successful clients are in the program for at least 6 months, because then we know we've hit that sort of sustainability point and the behaviors are becoming more normal, more automatic. But not only that, we've built up coping mechanisms for the moments when they're not automatic, the moments where circumstances change, the moments where they're in a different place or their habits have to shift or whatever. We have the change tools to actually deal with obstacles after that 6 month period of time.
That's so helpful. I think the timeline for me, it's comforting. And I know that I've had a lot of time to come to terms with the fact that fast generally doesn't last. And if we want true lasting behavior change, it's probably going to take more time than we want it to, but hey, you know, just the way the cookie crumbles. I understand the unique position that I am in as a coach who has had a lot of time to process that. I'm wondering if you've seen this be a lot of why people struggle to create true lasting behavior change, because they want it faster and are not willing to maybe practice or keep showing up for that length of time, because it's hard. Like, patience is hard. Let's call it what it is.
And I think that's part of the problem, is that there's tons of messages in the industry that are like, stop wanting a 30-day transformation. And it's like, no, it's natural to want fast change. It's okay to want fast change. I too wish my business would blow up overnight. I too wish that I could deadlift 600 pounds by the end of the year. And I can want that. I can even allow myself to want that. And I can redirect to my very good reasons for not pursuing a quick fix approach. So I think separating the desire from acting on that desire is a really, really important step. The other thing that I encourage people to think about is reframing and looking at the immediate benefits of an activity. So if you want to see instant transformation, look for it. Every single time I go to the gym, I instantly feel better afterwards. When I eat a vegetable, when I eat a high fiber, high protein dinner, I leave that meal feeling really, really, really satisfied. So immediate benefit and transformation is available to you if you're looking for it. But most people aren't looking for it because they're just looking at these enormous outcome variables rather than subtle but meaningful changes in the way they feel day to day.
Totally. That's going to be so relatable. I mean, in the world of weight loss, I think it's a great example in terms of I'm looking at the scale to tell me whether or not my behavior is reinforced or validated, when in reality, we're forgetting the fact that, like you mentioned, I have more energy when I eat a well-balanced meal that's hitting all of, you know, my nutritional needs, or I feel better throughout the day when I move my body intentionally. It may not result in an immediate change on the scale or change on the scale at all, but it still counts. That's something that I have to remind clients over and over again, and myself. A great example I can think of is a client who maybe forgot to put on their Apple Watch, or like their Fitbit died or something. And they're so distraught that nothing that they did counted. And I have to remind them that it still counts. It counts just as much as it ever counted. You just don't have that immediate number staring back at you from a screen on your wrist that's saying, hey, good job, you did it, but you still did it. And that kind of circles back to what you were saying earlier. Even eating a vegetable once counts. Like, there's benefit to doing something one time. There's benefit to doing something even if it doesn't produce immediate outcomes. And there's benefit to doing something even if you still have 6 months of doing that thing repeatedly before you actually feel as though it's somewhat automatic.
And I think, to your point, there's a real danger in only getting praise or reward from devices, other people, etc. If you feel like you're super attached to your step tracker and you need your Apple Watch to tell you whether or not you had a good week, that probably means you aren't telling yourself you had a good week. You aren't ever engaging in self-praise, in focusing on your strengths, in patting yourself on the back, in rewarding yourself for the things that have gone well. And behavior change research actually shows that people who are most successful with long-term behavior change, they are focused on their strengths. They are focused on what's going well, and they are engaging in that self-praise, self-appreciation, gratitude, but also like literally saying out loud to yourself, like, good job. I will say out loud to myself after I get out of the gym, good job, Karin. And that is so huge. That is a step in the behavior change process that I think the majority of people miss.
Which essentially is the embodiment of what we focus on expands, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm giving myself credit for showing up for myself, for fulfilling a promise, I'm more likely to do that in the future because I recognize the fact that I did it and I'm a badass.
Yes, 100%. And really quick on that is that memory isn't static. What we remember at any given moment is related to our identity. And so if you are identifying as a person who works out consistently, you're more likely to remember things that support that. But if you're identifying as a person who works out inconsistently, you're more likely to remember the moments in your life that reinforce that. And so focusing on your strengths actually creates this little memory loop where you're encoding memories that are more focused on your capabilities. Then that's lining up with your beliefs. You're remembering things that line up with the belief that you are capable, and then you're acting accordingly. So that praise is hugely important.
And increase self-efficacy, right? Mm-hmm. Full circle. I love it. I love it. Oh, Karin, this conversation made my day. I just want to say thank you for your time. You are immensely knowledgeable, and just you sharing your wisdom with us is incredible. And I can't wait for everyone to listen to our conversation. When they do, if they want to consume more of your content, they want to be informed about when you have your launches, where can they find you and connect with you online?
Yes, absolutely. So you can find me personally at Karin Nordine, PhD. That's my Instagram account. And then our company Instagram account is at Body Brain Alliance, and our website is bodybrainalliance.com. So I would definitely check that out.
I'll drop all the links in the show notes below so people can just click and find you. And again, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Health, Wealth, and Wisdom Podcast. If you like what you heard today, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe, and then head on over to nutritioncoachingwithnicole.com, where you can sign up for my weekly emails, where I send out my favorite tips, tricks, advice, and support every single Monday morning to help you kick your week off right. Thanks for listening. Until next time.